Mohamed Rafiq was on the staff of the Bank of England in the 1980s and knows how it works from the inside out. Unlike the public faces of the bank now, he's prepared to talk about it in honest language, which helps rather than hinders our understanding. And I spoke to him in South London earlier this week.
My name is Mohamed Rafiq. I've been working in central banking, banking and finance since about 1985. Of course, being a banker, I won't give you precise numbers. I'll give you approximations till such times we've got a contract in place and then you find out the real cost.
Okay, so but how did you get into, and you actually were a permanent employee at the Bank of England in the 1980s?
I was at the front ends of the Bank of England, known as the discount houses. We went through the big change process from the old manual paper systems, when a coupon really was a coupon, a piece of paper that did the rounds, got various stamps on it, and back then we would ring up banks to find out if a stamp was genuine or not, because you could fake a stamp with a potato, you know. I mean, it was that kind of security that went on back then. And we digitized, as part of the Big Bang process, was the digitization of all these traditional financial and banking products and shares, all these things that used to be certificates that are now digital. We went through the process of digitizing all of that.
So you're responsible for this electronic money, but you talk there about the front end. You sound like a cashier, but that's not it, is it? What's the front end and what was the back end of the Bank of England?
What I mean by the front end of the Bank of England is market facing. So it's still wholesale markets. We were still selling to the banks, but we were selling the UK Treasury bills and the UK gilts. People have to buy them from somewhere. Back then, you didn't buy direct from a central bank. You bought through one of the bank's discount houses, their licensed discount houses. They, in turn, would buy them directly from the Bank of England at an auction process. So as the front end, what I mean by that is that we were facing the rest of the world, selling off the gilts and the treasury bills for and on behalf of the Bank of England.
So the old paper system, did people have to physically come and pick up these various share certificates and bonds and this kind of thing? And how did that transfer over to the electronic version?
Yeah, absolutely. There used to be guys in the city known as messengers. These guys went running from one, literally running from one institution to the next, with satchels on their shoulders carrying bearer certificates. And that was the reason you needed bearer certificates, because it had to be the owner who redeemed them on maturity to go and collect the cash, because there was no other way of tracing them before the digital age. You turn up there with it in your hand, and if you set fire to it or it gets damaged or something like that, you've lost the money. I mean, it was very serious.
Did the messengers ever get lost on the way or disappear off abroad?
There were a few incidents where, for instance, in the snow, a messenger slipped and lost one of his satchels. That got handed in, and it had a large amount of paper money in it, as it's known. There is another instance where a messenger who heard some bad news delayed lodging his certificates with the bank till after 3 p.m, which meant that they didn't accrue any interest for that particular evening. And the amount of money that was lost in overnight meant that none of the messengers got a Christmas bonus that year.
I think many people would agree with you that economics is very difficult to understand and see through. Do you think that's deliberate, and that's what it really means, isn't it? But blinded by verbosity.
Absolutely. I mean, the economics does not hold any solutions for central banking or the banking system or for banks. It is not really possible to study central banking. The understanding that is taught in academia through economic circles has got very little to do with the practical reality on the ground. And that is simply because it's, you know, as the Americans would say, a bum steer. If people don't know what the actual subject is and the subject matter, they can talk till the cows come home about anything else. They can't fix anything because their core understanding is wrong.
Now, you paint the picture of a rather more of a sort of utilitarian, if we can say that, a kind of public utility version of the Bank of England back in the 80s. What's changed?
One of the things that we did in capturing the old paper system and looking at what bits of information were on what bits of paper and putting it all onto a huge grand design board and looking where this information flowed is we digitized that process and the information. What we didn't do was ask the question, do we need to do it like this? does DP, as it was then known, data processing, now IT, information technology, does IT give us a new way of doing this? So even without the conspiracy theory element, which isn't a theory, it's a conspiracy fact, as I was describing the difference between the understandings there, and that's carefully managed, because the people who understand what's going on pass that on an intergenerational basis, and it's a very limited need-to-know basis.
But it sounds almost like a cult.
Yeah, you could say it was almost like that. It was a money cult. I mean, these people had been earning from these processes for generations. In the same way somebody might be a rope maker or a candlestick maker or a smith of some description, these people passed on from one generation to the next, so that their children got this instant leg in. The institutions that I worked for instance, were purely old Etonian. So if you didn't have the old school tie, and everybody knows this, this is not a theory, this is fact, historical fact, if you didn't have the school tie, you didn't get on the board. It was that simple. It was got nothing to do with capability or qualification. It was completely a privileged hierarchy.
Back in the 1970s and 80s, I mean, in the 80s, and when we started dropping off from the idea of full employment, at some point, Britain has gone from being a country where money actually serves the population and serviced the nation to a point where we're now feeling that actually we are serving the money system. At what point did that happen?
Well, I think it's always been like that. I think that after the Second World War, they lifted the yoke slightly. But if you go back Second World War, you don't have to go back that far to find children cleaning the inside of chimneys, etc. So there was a system of slavery in this country that, although we like to look at slavery systems in other parts of the world, slavery did exist here. We had child slave labour. There were unions that fought against that to try and get some kind of equality in life. We kind of take all of those fights for granted now that went on back then, and think that this system, which is slowly, insidiously seeping its way into becoming the master of our lives, is something new. It's actually something returning, and hence the old mantra, those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. If we study the history of this system, we'll see very clearly that all that's happening is a repeat of what's happened previously. It's been digitized, it's sold in a different way, where it's marketed, and we're made to feel comfortable about it and made to feel that it's the right and proper thing, but actually it isn't. The whole thing needs challenging from the root up.
That's a challenging question in a way, and I'd like to put it to you. If you were sitting in George Osborne's shoes now, without David Cameron or a Prime Minister breathing down your neck, what kind of decisions would you be making about ways to put the country back on track, where we do have a financial system that operates in a sort of boring utility that just makes sure that everybody has a job, and that when they do, that they're getting a fair reward for it?
I think that the thing to understand is that there is a massive disconnect between the banking system and the central bank and the banks. Those three things are, although they're interlinked, they are separate, and they have nothing to do with the economy. Absolutely nothing to do with the economy, other than the measure of monetary supply, the money in supply, is an economic statistic. It's a fairly small number of statistics which are quoted within the economic paradigm. You know, when you look at a country and everything that happens within its economy, M0 through M4 is just a small set of numbers. But actually, that's done on purpose, because they don't want people looking at what goes on beyond that. So if we were to say, what would we be changing? I would be changing it not as an economist, and I would not be really making that many changes to the economy. What I would be doing would be changing the way the central bank worked, the way that our borrowing worked as a nation, the way that our money goes into supply as a nation, and I would also be looking at redesigning the banking system so that we're never in a situation of needing to bail it out ever again. Well, there are several ways that this can be done, and it's all about sequence. What you have is the where we are now, and if this were a project, we have the TOM, the target operating model. What I just described there is the target operating model that we need to get to. As with all projects, there's several stages that you can go through to get to that final point.
Well, let's you be our project manager then and take us through that, because I think we get a lot of criticism of the existing system, but very little explanation of what could be a plan B. So be our project project manager?
Okay, well, at the moment, we are project managing, I'll give two examples, Iceland and Greece. We look at two countries which both came croppers as a result of overborrowing, overleverage of the banks and a total failure. What we have is a completely different approach by the people, and this is what's crucial here, by the people and not the governments. It's not something that the governments did in Iceland, it's actually something the people did. The people marched on their government and their banks, put them in court, found them guilty, and put them in jail. So the first thing they did was say, you are the cause of the problem, therefore you cannot be part of the solution. And in fact, we find what you've done to have been criminal activity. So they were found guilty as criminals and jailed. In Greece, the Greek people have been told, in spite of their uprising and their protestations, you must take the medicine which is being dished out. You will stand by the government, you will stand by the banks, and you will take the measures, the so-called austerity measures, which is in itself a farcical word to use, because they're poverty measures. Austerity, just to open a small segue bracket here, austerity is something that you do on an individual basis. It's a self-discipline. I'm an austere person implies self-discipline. If I take money off somebody to the extent that he loses his home and has to sleep on the pavement, that is not somebody that we call austere. He is a victim of circumstance through external forces which have forced him into that position. So the Greeks have poverty measures which are being enforced on them through G10, certainly through the European Union, as things which they have to undertake and measures they have to do. We have a little bit of independence in the UK at this stage, which means, can we operate more like Iceland than Greece? The answer to that is yes. If we wanted to, we could say, well, let's have a look at the activities that have been going on and act accordingly. Now, anybody who follows the news recently will see nobody has gone to jail over LIBOR. The LIBOR fraud is probably the single biggest fraud that's been perpetrated on mankind in terms of the amount of nominal value that's behind it. It's probably 70 to 80 trillion pounds, and the interest on that amount through these derivative contracts that have got a sterling LIBOR leg on those contracts, out of a total of $700 trillion worldwide. So we're talking about 14-15% of contracts, something like that, have got a sterling leg. Every single one of those perpetrators should be in jail. They are fraudsters. They've committed fraud on an enormous scale. So the first thing that we have to do to change things is to start calling a spade and not an implement for the rearrangement of earth and blah, blah, blah.
But isn't there a bit of confusion over whether it's the actual traders themselves or the people on the boards of those banks that committed LIBOR fraud?
The fact of the matter is that they employed fraudsters, and if they didn't know fraud was going on in their banks, then they're incompetent and need dismissing as well. The fact of the matter is that in order to clean this house out, it's a very old saying, if you don't learn from these simple idioms in history, you're always going to fail, a new broom sweeps clean. You've got to go in there and clean out the house. The people who made this mess cannot fix it. That's the first thing that the people of Iceland got right. The second thing they then did was say, we will not be held hostage to this debt. We are not paying this debt. We are walking away from it. You can do what you want to our national credit rating. You can call us defaulters. You can call us whatever you want. This debt was taken on by these criminals. It's their responsibility. Because their actions were criminal, we don't accept any liability. So the debt was then written off. So the people of Iceland are now starting with a clean slate. The reason that the people of Greece are committing suicide to the extent that they are, that they're suffering this enormous misery, is because people are not writing off the debt. They shouldn't have got there. The people who borrowed that national debt were criminals. There's something like 360 billion euros worth of debt for an economy that was 25% of that. It should never have been allowed to go over the 1-to-1 ratio. Bottom line, those people who did that, put them in jail and just write the debt off. That's the first stage.
You're actually implying that it's the people's responsibility, but actually People have protested both in Iceland and in Greece. Isn't it really more to do with the size of the country and the accessibility of the politicians and the government?
No, I think that when we say the people, we have to ask ourselves, do the police consider themselves to be people? Does the state prosecutor consider himself to be one of the people? These people committed criminal acts. If the police and the state prosecutor have sufficient grounds to consider someone's committed a crime, you get them arrested. It's that simple. So we have to now ask the question, what kind of government and what kind of policing is in place where acts which are clearly defined as criminal acts, same in the UK, these are being smoothed over by government in the UK, libel, everybody engaged in that is a fraudster. And if people at the top knew that their lackeys were up to this on their swaps desks, then they are equally guilty. And then we have to ask the question, well, you didn't know it was going on, so that's negligence. They're guilty of one crime or the other. They took on a huge amount of money belonging to the British people and international people for that matter, and they are paid handsomely for that responsibility. Now, to behave criminally on top of that is a crime. And just because they got smart suits and just because they make lots of money does not make them immune to criminality. Until such time as this country turns round and starts arresting these criminals and putting them in jail, you're not going to change anything.
Is it possible that the City of London Police, which is a special jurisdiction all of its own, is kind of in the pocket of the city and that they are rather too pally and they know they're not going to be arrested by the City Police?
Well, the City of London Police always look for heads of security jobs at the time that they retire within the banks. So they're always overly pally in that particular neck of the woods, unfortunately. But as we know, the police and Murdoch's media were overly pally. This seems to be a common problem within the police forces generally, that they themselves don't have enough independent review and control. But the point is that in the court of public opinion, we, the people, have seen criminals being forgiven their criminality for paying an upfront fine. These people are not going to jail. What kind, just very simply, let's just ask ourselves, what kind of message does that send out to anybody else engaged in banking activity and financial activity that's thinking, yeah, the bank will pay a fine, I don't do any time, what's to stop me? There's no moral hazard. There's no downside to taking that kind of a criminal risk, so why not do it? So the first thing we have to do is stop talking about regulation and stop talking about financial crime, because financial crime is the sort of thing that if somebody in your local branch stole £50 out of the safe would be sacked, and we'd expect them to be vilified in the media and all of these kinds of things. We'd expect their name to be mud. But if the crime's big enough, the government is papering over it.
But it seems to me what you're saying then essentially is, looking at Iceland and Greece and Britain, is that really this is about policing. What about the Serious Fraud Office? If the City of London Police aren't going to arrest anybody, what about them in Scotland Yard?
This is a political will that politicians are overriding the behaviour of people whose job it is to detect crime and to enforce procedures against crime. Somebody somewhere is smoothing all of that over. We could look, for instance, at Hector Sants, the recent head of the FSA, who's now leaving to become head of compliance at Barclays Bank. Managed to get himself a nice £3 million a year package. This was the man who a couple of years ago was telling everybody that he was on the warpath against overpaid banking directors. Here he is with a £3 million a year package, 750,000 basic, plus. Can't help but wonder if the man's not been bought off for making sure that the FSA doesn't insist the police prefer charges as well. Looks like a payoff to me.
Given that that's really essentially where you're coming from, that people do have to actually go to jail, can you see that happening here in Britain?
I think that there will come a stage where the people will have had enough, because the other thing is, what do we need to do to change it? Well, there's a series of measures, and as I say, for me, those are the first steps, because that shows serious intent. By arresting people and putting them in jail for the crimes they've committed, what we're actually saying is, we won't stand for this behaviour in future. Anybody that does this in future can expect jail. That's a great deterrent in itself, and it's a commitment to future generations that we want behaviour with integrity and honesty within side of our financial dealings. Without that message going ahead, we can't change. If we can't change, where do we go? The answer is Greece. We will end up in a Greek situation. That is the medicine. And let's just, you know, again, common sense hat on now, Tony. 6 years they've had. Northern Rock blew up 6 years ago, 2007. We're into 2013, 6 years. All of the quantitative easing, all of the different measures, everything that they've done, the lowering of interest rates, the doing of this, the doing of that, all the buttons and knobs and whistles at their controls that they've managed to turn, in 6 years, the situation is still getting progressively worse. Anybody, you don't have to be Albert Einstein to realise it means that what they're doing isn't working. If it hasn't worked for 6 years, it's not going to work over the next 6 years. So this is simply a pain game. The British public will end up in similar levels of pain to the people of Greece. We will end up there because that's where this road goes. Nothing that they do is going to alter that course. They need to behave in a different way and to press different buttons and to come up with different solutions to these problems. So I believe, ultimately, that level of pain, when we've lost enough jobs, when we've lost enough retail, when we've lost enough manufacturing, when people have had enough, we might get to a Jarrow March type situation. But unfortunately, we're in a situation where rather than people being proactive, they're going to be reactive. And that's the problem. People who've been talking in advance about this, have been trying to warn where this is heading, they're proactive and saying, let's act now before we end up in this train crash. In the meantime, a lot of other people say, well, I'll wait for the train crash and then worry about the fact that the train's crashed. Not a helpful attitude, but that's the dilemma that we're really facing, I believe.
So will we end up with a sort of elite of super rich and a kind of almost Victorian or medieval underclass of people who are simply dying?
Well, we're almost there anyway. I mean, we already have a super powerful financial elite. That's a reality. They are an elite who, as I've just been describing, consider themselves to be outside the law. They behave with impunity. They commit criminal acts for which the rest of us go to jail and they don't. Anybody that can't see that as a two-tier system is utterly blind and they're wasting their time listening to this radio program.
So, I mean, it sounds like the law of the jungle. Isn't there a sort of fascistic, I mean, I hesitate to use the word, but aspect to this sort of Ian Duncan Smith approach of punishing disabled people when we can see that the bankers are actually walking away with even bigger tax breaks, it looks like this year at Goldman Sachs, for example?
Well, they have to try and rein the finances in somewhere, and they're just looking for soft targets. They're looking for people that don't finance their lifestyles, people that they're not frightened of challenging. It's easy to pick on somebody who's disabled, isn't it, at the end of the day? This is a culture of victimization. You look for the softest targets and you take money from them. That's precisely what's going on, and that's what I'm saying. We have a multi-tier Britain already.
This is really like dog eat dog. I mean, that's a pretty dark road to go down.
It already is that. I mean, we are in that dark road. That's why we see retail stores closing. We're here in my local town of Croydon. Alder's department store was one of the oldest department stores in the UK. It's now closed after 120 years of being in business or whatever. We are losing these things in the high street because the money's not there to spend. It's not there to spend because the banks have got it. We've given huge amount. I mean, let's not forget, Gordon Brown gave £1,000 billion, £1 trillion in bailout money to the banks. Yet this is a man who can't find £200 million, and to understand that, that's by a factor of 50,000. 1/50,000th of what he gave to the banks, he can't find for junior and primary school education. So you have to ask yourself the question, where does this guy find this enormous money to help out this small power elite to maintain their control system, which is what it is, and yet can't find a few quid here and there for people whose tax is being used to bail out this ultra uber wealthy group?
What about 2008, then, what would have happened if banks had been allowed to collapse? Surely that would have been horrific.
No, if Northern Rock had been allowed to collapse, that would have been one of the best things that would have ever happened in the UK. The dust would have settled probably 3 years ago by
now. But what about the bigger banks, RBS, Lloyds?
Well, it's arguable that by allowing the smaller ones to fail and the ones that should have failed when they failed to have failed, all the rest of the books would have balanced elsewhere. So that's my point. Northern Rock, the first round of bailout cash was $25 billion by Gordon Brown. That was then followed up by two further amounts after it's been nationalised to a total of £75 billion. Just the initial $25 billion, Northern Rock had 8,000 employees, so £25 billion represents £3 million more than per employee in the bailout. £3 million per employee. We'd have been better off laying them off and giving them £1 million each, and we'd have actually saved 16 billion quid from the public purse. But I think if we said to people we're going to give all ex-Northern Rock employees £1 million each, people's hair would have been on fire and they'd have been jumping up now saying, we don't want that. But we actually have taken on £75 billion worth of Northern Rock liability. Should have just let it go.
So theft and robbery, this is the word picture you're painting, but the police haven't acted and nobody's really been arrested. One or two kind of token gestures.
Yep, token fines and paying fines before anybody goes into open court. That should never be allowed. A crime is a crime. Somebody goes out and rapes a woman and then they turn around and say, oh, we'll pay a fine to the FSA rather than face preferred charges. It's the job of the police to prefer charges and the Crown Prosecution Service where a crime has been committed. The evidence is in the public domain that this crime has been committed, not just the LIBOR, but I'm talking about all the other criminality that's gone on, because the government has behaved criminally in bailing out the banks. It had no right to do that. A system existed previously whereby the Bank of England was known as the lender of last resort. The Bank of England had open windows by which it was allowed to bail banks out. Once it reached those limits, no bank is allowed to receive any further money. Not only did the banks go over those limits, but Gordon Brown stepped in, as we just described with Northern Rock, and went massively over the failure window. They should have been allowed to fail like Barings was. But unfortunately, Gordon Brown's ego is the kind of man where he would not allow a failure to occur on his watch, because he wants everyone to think that he's the greatest living Chancellor of the Exchequer that history's ever seen. I did a review of his biography, his autobiography, and nearly every other page is how I saved the world. It's actually embarrassing to read it.